You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
From our studio to yours, this is Various Artists.
Ahia hi mari e, tēnā koutou katoa, ko mea toka ingoa.
Ko sofia toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki Various Artists mō tēnei wiki. How are you today, my
I'm
girl?
I'm good, I'm glad you're back with me.
I know, I had a minor hiatus last week. I was at the New Zealand International Film Festival, checking out Pavements, great film, recommend to a friend. But we're so back, and I'm
so
glad to be here.
Back.
And we've got some great interviews on the show today. Maya, what have you got?
Yeah, I had a kōrero with Kat Fuchs about her current show at Anna Miles, Didymus Mountains.
And I had a kōrero with Kairohi, curator of Art Space Aotearoa, Robbie Hancock, about their latest group exhibition, The Tongue to Them.
He aha o whakara, we would love to hear your thoughts on these pieces. So tuku patsuhi mai, you can text us on 5395-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5-5
Also after the show, koa e ware ware e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō hei pakihere rokiroki maronga i te pai toku toku. Where am I? Hirirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these chats and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. God, a week off. What does it do to me?
What's it all for?
Various artists.
The Tongue to Them is the latest exhibition at Artspace Aotearoa, bringing together the works of Darcel Apulu, Martha Atienza, Heidi Brickle, Buck Nin and Yi Lan. Together, the artists contemplate collectivity and language as tools for resistance through their respective visual mediums and languages from across Aotearoa, Malaysia and the Philippines that they bring into Artspace Aotearoa's space. I had a kōrero with Kairohi, curator of Artspace Aotearoa, Robbie Hancock, about this exhibition and the ideas that bind these artists and their practices together. Here is our interview now. The Tongue to Them takes its name from a poem by Filipino nationalist and writer Jose Rizal, My Mother Tongue. Tell me a bit more about this choice of title and how Rizal in this poem speaks to the kaupapa of this exhibition currently on at Artspace Aotearoa.
Oh, good first question. Yeah, Jose Rizal is considered a national hero in the Philippines. And in the Philippines, and I think this exists across certain other Asian nations as well, the idea of a national hero is almost a formal kind of title. Like there's recognition in a way that is... Yeah, I guess more formal than how we might use that word here at Aotearoa. So Jose Rizal is considered to be instrumental in the Philippine Revolution, not actively, but in inspiring it. So in his writing, in his language, in his research and work, really influenced the Philippine resistance, which was against the Spanish colonial government of the time. And so, interestingly, Philippines Independence Day recognizes Philippines' independence from Spain, but that isn't when Philippines gained nationhood and state independence, because it was then under the US government and it didn't receive its actual independence until the 1940s. But collectively as a nation, the 1890s independence from Spain is what is recognized. In terms of the title, the poem itself is quite a, like, almost cheesy poem about pride in your mother tongue. And that particular excerpt, or that particular grouping of words, the tongue to them, I felt, it had a nice poetry in itself, but it's also sort of ambiguous. The tongue to them is also, can sort of speak to conversing with someone else, speaking to another, but it also sounds a bit like a front. I don't know, it's like a, like pulling the fingers somehow, it also sounds a bit like that. So I kind of liked a bit of that. It's not quite a double entendre, but a dual sense of meaning, if that makes sense.
No, totally, it does. I see what you mean. This exhibition is bringing together five artists from Aotearoa, Malaysia and the Philippines. to kind of get into talking about the works, would you like to firstly briefly introduce each artist and their work that is being exhibited in this show?
Yes, as briefly as I can. Yilan's works in this exhibition really formed an anchor for me that with other works and artists really built around it. So Yilan is a Malaysian artist with a historically primarily lens and video practice, but in the last 5 to 10 years she's been working with communities weaving communities. So these the works in here are called Tika Meja. It's a suite of mats, all each depicting a table. Each mat is woven by the Baja Dalat people, who are the knowledge holders of this particular mat. And for Yilan, the table stands in as a symbol of the administrative violence of colonization. When she talks about the table and these particular works, she talks about administration being as much, if not more, violent than physical violence. So, for instance, if we think of treaties or map making or education, these are all systems that demarcate where people are and tell people who they are. And so it's this, she calls it sort of like a rock, paper, scissors game where the table is on a mat and the mat is conversely open source, community-led and often women-led as well. So by having these tables on the mat can roll up the table and eat it. Second, we have Dasal Apelu. The work in the exhibition is Ingress Egress. So she has taken the form of Waharoa, which is the gateway or entrance down in a Pau Marayam, and has sort of inverted that sense of thoroughfare. So it becomes a bit more of a blockade. It becomes a bit like a monument in itself. So, yeah, playing on an idea of welcome. Heidi Brickle we have in the exhibition. She comes from an education background, really steeped in material revitalization. She has a painting and a sculpture practice. In this exhibition, we have three sculptures that form a reference to a whakatoki that I can't remember off the top of my head, but translates to die like a shark, lest you die like a squid. So there's forms here that are referencing both the squid and the shark. We have Martha Atienza from the Philippines, two video works playing back-to-back in the gallery called Anito 1 and Anito 2. They are both filming a local festival on Bantayan Island where she lives. And in the festival, it's this kind of spontaneous, like, frenzied street parade in which villagers, locals will impromptu dress up and parade down the street. And what happens is they're often referring to or responding to particular current events that are relevant at the time. So you'll see glimpses of costumes relating to particular significant typhoons that have happened around the time. And one in particular, or Anito 2 in particular, responds quite explicitly to President Duterte's war on drugs during 2017 and his raids and his presidency at that time. And then lastly, we've got Bucknin, who is a really significant Māori artist and significant force in Māori arts education. So as part of this exhibition, we have one of his lithograph prints on site, but we have also one of his paintings considered part of the exhibition but remains off-site at its home in Te Aumutu at the head offices of Te Wānanga o Aotearoa, which is an institution that he was quite integral to helping them set up tertiary status.
You mentioned there that Yilan's work was kind of your starting point for putting together this exhibition. But can you speak to how you kind of went from there and went about selecting the other four artists for this show?
Yeah, so there's quite a few connections between the works and there's quite a few connecting relationships, I think, that have come up by chance through working through this exhibition. I mean, one thing with Yilan's works with the tables that I was thinking through. So you know, I've used the Austronesian language family as a sort of small ring fence to try and hold, as a basket to hold these practices together, to sort of ask that question of what conversations can be had when you share a mother tongue or when you share a root tongue. The table in all these languages represented in this exhibition retains its foreigner status. So Tika Meja, the title of the work, Meja. Tika is the Malay word for mat. Meja comes from the Portuguese word for table. In Tagalog, it's mesa, which is the Spanish word for table. And in Te Reo Māori, it is tepu, which is a transliteration of table. Yeah, I mean, I guess the other connection between the artists is that sense of collectivity. So the behind-the-scenes work, I think, that happens with in these arts practices was of interest to me. So in terms of Ilan, she works quite a bit in Malaysia with governance and sort of these structural realms of power. With Martha, she has an NGO on the island where she lives that advocates for her village and in particular, I think, the fishermen on her village for sustainable environmental practices in response to tourism or local government imperatives. And then the other three artists, Heidi, Darcel and Buck, are also all educators. And so that sort of, that formalizing of collectivity, I think, was quite interesting to me as a background commonality between them as well. In terms of other reasons for this, I mean, I guess I was interested to bring artists into the exhibition that haven't shown an art space before. And I think that's true except for Darcel, who did some early chopping performances in the old art space when it was upstairs.
You've kind of weaved through in your answer there these ideas that are connecting the artists together and the works together. And I guess to add to that, each work articulates these experiences of colonization, particularly in relation to Art Space Aotearoa's annual question, is language large enough? Are you able to speak more on how this underlying kaupapa that binds these artists together responds to Art Space's annual question?
Yeah, I guess I've used it quite literally in selecting and in using a language family as a ring fence to think about conversation between artworks and artists. And I think in terms of the articulation of experience, I mean, I think maybe the difference is I didn't want the show to be about colonization. I wanted it to be about how these artists communicate with the world. I think one thing that was interesting, that's a particular of the Austronesian language family, is that most versions of this language will have a distinct we, or at least two versions of the word we, a listener inclusive and a listener exclusive. So in English, we can't differentiate between, when I say we, does that mean you as well, or does that mean us without you, kind of thing. Whereas we have different words for that in a lot of Austronesian languages, which can clarify what collective we're speaking about quite quickly. And I think that mode of identification, I think, is active in various parts of these works. Who is the we? Who is the listener included? And who is the listener excluded? Which I think makes for an interesting way that they interact with each other and how audiences might interact with it.
For sure. I really like that that conversation around this idea of we. I find that really interesting because I've picked that up with other languages as well, and it's interesting to compare and contrast.
I think as well, I mean, this is sort of one other example, you know, like Austronesian language families will often have a different U's, right? So a U for one, a U for two, a U for three or more, which is something that English doesn't have. But I feel like in sort of our, you know, Kiwi vernacular, that's something that a lot of us will say U's as a plural U. And it's a funny sort of compensation, I think, or trying to put back in a function to a language that has lost that, or that the impulse of the person is to clarify and to use what tools or you know, play with grammar in a way to sort of make it make sense conceptually rather than grammatically is maybe one of those impulses. But interestingly, you used to be plural and the was the singular you. And during Shakespearean time, that switched for some reason and you became singular. That does not need to be included in anything, but I thought that was an interesting little
No, it is interesting. Did you ever study linguistics?
No, I didn't. I think, you know, growing up, I grew up between Australia, the Philippines, and Aotearoa. And I think when you're a bilingual child, a lot of those, maybe just when you're sort of bilingual anyway, you become a lot more aware of the mechanics of different languages. So that's always been something of interest to me. We have an amazing set of poems as part of our reading room that sits alongside this exhibition by Gregory Kahn. It's a selection of five poems that's available to read on our website, or we have printouts physically in the gallery. But they're taken from his two previous collections of poetry, Under Glass and Clay Eaters. And I think what sort of there's interesting relationships between these works and the exhibition as well, in terms of Greg sort of, you know, having, I think, some in his most recent book, there's some more literal references to his time in the army. And in that book, there's also a really interesting table that has created of overlaps between Malay words and Te Reo words as well.
That was Kairohi, curator of Artspace Aotearoa, Robbie Hancock, speaking to me about their latest exhibition, The Tongue to Them. The show is on now until the 4th of October.
Tēnā koe. Ko Peter Robinson, tōku ingoa. You're listening to BFM.
We'll be right back after a little break. This is Some Vanishing Twin. You're on BFM.
I'm rooting for Witness Living Art at Basement Theatre this winter season. Happening now, expect a blistering lineup with a brand new show opening every week, including works from an incredible array of daring, hilarious, and innovative theatre makers.
Soak up the sweat, tears, and blood of the performers.
Not real blood, though.
You'll have to decide for yourself. It's theatre!
Stoke your winter fires at Basement Theatre. For the full program and tickets, head to basementtheatre.co.nz.
Wow, we get along so well. I feel like I've known you my whole life.
I know, it's crazy. I'd love to see you again.
Sorry, I just have to ask. Your hoodie is so random. What is 95BFM?
Oh, I knew this was too good to be true.
What? Wait, where are you going?
No!
Show the world exactly who you are with our range of classic 95BFM merch. From the BSA slogan t-shirt to ringer tees and hoodies, get yours now at twotonesmerch.co.nz.
All-time indie rock icons Block Party are headed back to Aotearoa at last, playing August 12th at Spark Arena.
Celebrating the 20th anniversary of their critically acclaimed debut album, Silent Alarm, Block Party are set to play the album in full, plus all the hits that followed it.
The bold and beautiful sound of Block Party, back at last, playing Spark Arena on August 12th.
Get your tickets from Ticketmaster, or listen to 95BFM all this week to win a couple.
Of course, it is within this...
Hey! Do you have a pen?
What?
A pen. I forgot my laptop.
Look, you're going to have to speak up. What was it?
Nothing. Don't worry.
Would you be quiet?
What? Honestly, so hard to hear over all this shushing. You people ought to be ashamed. Some of us actually give a hoot about Commerce 335.
Tune in to Ready, Steady, Learn as a motley crew of academics from the University of Auckland take us through a range of thought-provoking topics. Every Tuesday on 95BFM Breakfast, thanks to the University of Auckland.
Do you growl towards the weekend on a Friday afternoon like the cockroach that hides in the corner of your room and crawls towards your sleeping face at night to slither inside your ear and lay its eggs?
Well, it's lucky we have this show to jolt you awake and stop all that disgusting crawling.
It's the Friday 2 to 4
with a brain-birthing cast of DJs ready to get you hyped for the weekend.
Various artists, so you can go to the opening for more than just the snacks.
Kat Fuchs is a Tamaki-based material-led painter who immerses herself within the world of her studio, in which Kat no longer views it as just a physical space, but rather its own dimension built up of paint and clutter that is crucial to the making of the works. Her current exhibition, Didymus Mountain, presents a series of vibrant and playful paintings, little worlds of abstract colour and texture that seem to rebel against the typical convention of the frame, engulfing the frame itself in a multitude of rich layers of paint, rejecting this framing and instead bringing it into the world of the painting itself, eliminating the space between the painting and the space of the world. I had a chat with Kat about her overall practice and the show. Do you start off by introducing yourself and your overall practice, the key mediums that you gravitate towards, as well as the thematic and or material glue of your practice, the thing that kind of acts as a undercurrent between all projects?
Yeah, hi, thanks for having me on. It's great to be here. I am a painter and I've been working on my craft for a number of years now. And I'd say that what I'm really focused on is the material of paint and kind of permeates everything that I do, drives my studio practice, really.
And your current show is called Didymus Mountain, which showcases a series of wonderfully playful, both vibrant and textural paintings that takes its title from the pseudonym of Thomas Hill, who was a Elizabethan astrologer, cosmologist, and author of the 1577 guide, The Gardener's Labyrinth. Could you speak a bit to its influence on this body of work, as well as the idea as gardening as this analogy for painting?
Yeah, so I mean, with every show comes the pressure to come up with a great title, and also with titling the works as well. Mm. And so usually nearing the end of my run in the studio of making the works, I start to sort of focus on thinking about, you know, ideas and influences and just thinking around the works and what they're making me trigger and think about. And I was really thinking about medieval gardens and, yeah, garden design. And I was looking actually for women garden designers who worked and were influential back in that medieval time, and there actually weren't that many women garden designers at that time, not surprisingly. But I did discover Didi Mismountain, and I just thought when I read about Thomas Hill, he was like such a Renaissance man, and well, first of all, the name made me laugh out loud, and I was like, this is crazy. And then I thought, I quite like the pun that his name's Hill, but he chose mountain. And then Didymus actually is Greek, and it means pairing, so it means two.
Oh, okay.
And I quite like that idea because I have actually made sort of subconsciously sets of works in the studio, so there's sort of two or three that pop out of the same ilk. And not all of them make it into the show. Some of them are on the cutting room floor, but they sort of are in clumps, you know. And so I just thought this is a great name. No one's going to know what it means. And
I don't think I've ever heard of it.
Yeah. And so it was esoteric enough for me to run with that. So it was the first illustrated garden book. The gardening metaphor is really interesting. And Anna's written a great text that's on the poster that it's kind of encapsulates these ideas. But I do have a garden, and I'm really interested in gardens and gardening. And I really I find that it's the backdrop of it really it feeds into the painting practice, and it's imbued in my work. The paintings are not about gardens or flowers or anything botanical as such, but the feelings and the beauty and just the overall sense of nature, I think, is in the work in some form. And also I like the metaphor of just that idea of toiling away and having to plant seeds and then wait for them to grow, and like that is all really about having a studio practice as well. It's just like you're in that constant sense of graft and toil and work.
Yeah, it's funny, my I'm a painter and my mum is a gardener, and she always tells me that her painting is her garden, and like she kind of like references it in these like little like the way that she takes care of it and nurtures it and plants and
And I share my garden with my mum and my brother and sister and my dog Minty, and so it's a family affair. And the thing is that my brother always says, you know, you garden like you work in the studio, so your process is exactly the same, and it's kind of a nightmare. Like you want to paint, you want to sort of like I want to paint over everything, and you want to plant over everything and crowd out the plants, and you want riotous colours that don't seemingly won't go together, but then they somehow totally work together.
And you've mentioned before that your studio space that you've occupied for nearly 15 years acts more than just a physical space, but rather that it has become more like its own world, dictated by your own personality, in which the clutter and the dirty floor are part of and critical to the working process itself. Could you speak a bit more to the world of your studio and what your creative process looks like?
Yeah, well, I was sort of thinking about this morning, and I was thinking that the studio is kind of my bubble. So, yeah, the studio is really, really important to me because it's total freedom. Yeah, the routine of that is really important. So knowing that you don't have to pack up and go and put it all in a suitcase and go somewhere with it. Painting is really hard, and it's really hard to paint sometimes. And so you have to get there and then open that door, take a deep breath and just start and think, have some faith that something's going to happen. And you know this because you're a painter and you just graduated from Elam. But I've got this show and tell story happening because I really wanted to read out some quotes that I thought were just amazing and have really, really sum up my practice and what I think about what it is to be a painter. But so the book is called Martin Gayford, How Painting Happens, brackets, and Why It Matters. And it's Thames and Hudson, and it came out last year. And he is an art writer and has written many books on Hockney and Lucian Freud, Auerbach, a lot of different painters in from the 60s onwards, and found some really good quotes, and I'm just going to dive in here and have a look.
Wonderful.
He once met Peter Doig, who's a painter, and he wanted to talk to him about how he knows when a painting's finished, because that's one of the chapters.
Yes.
And he says here, Peter Doig says, "I guess I feel a painting is finished when it stops bugging me, when I stop thinking about it, or start thinking about it in a different way, start just looking at it. I got to that stage last night at about 4 o'clock in the morning. It had taken quite a long time, but it's not a problem anymore. It doesn't make me want to vomit." And I just really like that visceral response to painting, because it is, it's such a struggle, and it is actually a bit like that when you, you know, you're so invested emotionally into what you're doing that you it does have a visceral reaction when you do feel a sense of euphoric.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I've nailed this painting. It's so amazing. And then and then that classic familiar feeling of you leave and then you come back the next morning and you're like, oh, da doll. And then because you often, I find the closer I get to a show as well that I get really, it gets harder and harder for me to perceive and discern if anything's good. So I will get some trusted people to come in and be like, I just don't know anymore if this is, are these are any good? Should I keep working on them or not? And then it's like, no, tools down. Or like, put that. So I've started a system now where I do have a shelf and I will put works on it that are like, I think that's a pass. And then I can put it out of the way and carry on without tinkering on it. But because I was just going to say, back to my show, people can go and see it and have a look at it, but the paintings are all really overpainted, and there's a lot of layering that's happened. So it's like many paintings that have been edited out on top of each other that's resulted in the final painting.
Yeah.
And then embedded in the painting are things that I've wanted to use to build up the surface or build up the frame. Frank Auerbach, who's a painter, he was the kitchen sink painter in the 1950s and onwards in the UK, around the time of Lucian Freud and Leon Kozlov and things. But he uses a lot of paint, and it's oil paint. But the difference with Auerbach is that he scrapes it off. So he obsessively works up his surfaces, but he'll remove it and then start again and remove it until he's satisfied. But he said here, occasionally I feel I've grown too adept at what I'm doing. It seems to me that one of the differences between interesting and uninteresting painters is that interesting painters start anew every time they paint a picture, and I try and do that. Then I try to find something that I've absolutely no idea how to cope with. And I kind of, I really, that idea resonates with me, because it is a matter of, it's that fine balance of like, okay, you've been doing this for 20 years, you know what you're doing, and you know how what materials and what paint's going to do. But you've also, you've got to have that sense in the studio where you're like, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. And you've got to be right on the edge of that feeling of like the abyss of not knowing.
Yeah, it's like the element of discovery and just like being, letting yourself be in that space where you don't know. Like, you don't know what it's going to be, and that's really exciting but terrifying. But you just, but, I mean, that's where it comes out of, those little
pockets. Yeah, it's, I was going to say exactly the same thing, that it's exciting but it's also terrifying.
Yeah.
And so he also says here, I could read you the whole book, but we don't have time, but he says here, carrying on and hoping for a miracle is Auerbach's method, just as scraping down and starting afresh day after day was Leon Kozlov's, as we will see. And even when a painter of this kind succeeds, they do not necessarily know how they did it.
Yes.
When I spoke to Cecily Brown, who's another female painter who uses a lot of paint, she had recently finished a work that she was really pleased with, but she went on to say, I absolutely no idea how I did it. The way I was putting the paint on was brand new, and I can't really recreate that, nor would I want to. Often you don't know how you did something. And, yeah, I mean, I just, I really, again, the dichotomy of knowing your craft and being able to be really proficient with it, but then also leaving room for chance and serendipity in the studio and being like, I don't know how I did that. Oh, my God, that is such a happy accident or mistake.
Those are like the best works, the ones that you just, like, you don't know how you made it. And it's like, you know, you did it, but it's like, you kind of got so lost in it that it's kind of like,
there's a disassociation.
And
I think what I would say about, I mean, this is the thing about having a show that's so amazing and such a privilege, is that you get to pop up once a year and you get to see your works in this amazing jewel box of a gallery with these gorgeous walls that Anna's painted all the different colours, and it's just looking so fine. And it's the reward for that is, you know, all that graft and toil and time to get to that point. And also there's all of the paint, there's all the failed paintings that trail along behind you, and there's all the sort of detritus and tears and other things, but the end result is a really cohesive show that hangs together and is otherworldly. It's like you don't know how you got there, and you don't know, you just can't even imagine that you did it. You're not recognizing it as your own as your own labor of love, but it is.
Your work almost rebels against this typical idea of the frame. The frame being this border in which a painting itself is kept within, acting as this border between the world of the painting and the space of the world. But within your works, you completely eliminate this border and bring the frame into a place of the painting itself. What led you to this treatment of the frame, and what does this lack of separation between the painting and the world bring to the work itself and the experience of the work?
Originally, it was kind of a practical decision. I'm quite a resourceful person, being a Capricorn. And so I sort of started off with, you know, finding a lot of substrates and using found board and paintings from op shops and things that already had frames existing on them, other people's canvases that they were like, I'm moving out. Do you want to have a whole lot of my stretches that I don't need anymore?
Okay.
And I was there with my car to like load it up. So I got pretty flexible at experimenting with different surfaces and board and canvas and fronts and backs and sides. And as I got further down the tunnel of it, I realized that I am really interested in the framing device of a painting and the form inside and the relationship between the two. And I'm really interested in edges. So for me, the edges of the paintings are just as much fascinating as the edges of where the frame hits the interior of a painting.
Yeah, that's my favorite.
And how all the tension arises between those formal elements. And so, but also the other thing was that all artists struggle, I think, in their own way with what to paint. You know, you have to come to it in your own time and realization of what it is that you want to actually do. And what the epiphany really was that I realized that I'm a process-based artist. So the abstract work or the result comes out of the process of the doing. So I make things that come out of the craft of applying the paint. So one thing leads to another, and it will inform me as to what that picture is going to end up looking like. So I've sort of gotten less and less interested in the idea of painting a form or the actual content in the middle of a picture, and I'm like more interested in making a painterly object that it still is a reference as a painting, it still has a frame, but it's actually about the making of that painting that interests me, and then how it comes out and comes out into the world. But I think I liked what you said about that refusal, or that sort of, what did you, the word that you used?
Rebelling. A rebelling
again. Yeah, I liked, because I think that there is something in me that does want to rebel against that kind of really lovely bourgeois idea of that gorgeous, big, luscious painting on Belgian linen with the with the gorgeous, like, Remu handcrafted frame around it, and it just looks really expensive and it smells expensive and it's like you can totally identify it. It's got all the signifiers of being a painting.
Yeah.
And I think I am interested in subverting that idea and getting away from that. I'm not wanting to make paintings like that, so
yeah.
That's good, because I won't and I never will, and that's easy.
I kind of see the paintings of this wall as kind of expansion of the painting themselves. Within your show, each wall that the paintings are being shown on is painting a different colour, mimicking the colours from within the paintings, and further leaning into this rejection of the neutral space between, as the typical white gallery wall normally acts as a kind of extension of the typical frame. Could you talk a bit about this decision and how it plays into the ideas of the work?
Yeah, well, I was going to say that Anna had been travelling earlier this year to the Munich Jewellery Festival, and she took the opportunity to go and see a lot of amazing galleries in Europe that had painted their walls in quite dark, deep, rich colours. Mm. And she actually did send me an image saying, you know, inspiration for your show. And, yeah, initially I was sort of like, wow, this is a pretty rich forest green, but can my paintings handle it? And what's the outcome of that? But then once we actually were in the space and we were installing the show and hanging them up, it became apparent that they not only could totally handle that colour, but they actually really popped on that wall. And this is a terrible term, it sounds like we're in one of those renovation home shows, but yeah, I mean, I think what I think's really great about the show and the colours, so there's, to offset the green is a beautiful buttery yellow in one wall, and it's is an interesting choice. Anna put the Gondwana Land painting, which is a sort of a primarily yellow on a yellow wall, which was quite a bold idea, and it didn't get eaten up by the yellow wall. But I think what's really great about the show is that it's a domestic scale of painting that I'm doing, and perhaps the wall colours are, you know, it's slightly more of a feeling like you're in a home with someone who's perhaps done, dare we say it, a feature wall. yeah. And it's not too far removed from how you could visualize living with that, with those works. And that's actually really great, because my paintings, they are sort of smaller scale, and they do live with me in my house, and I do live with them, and I change them out. And yeah, it's that daily outing of just quietly, it's just there as you make your morning coffee and you you know, choosing what you're going to watch on Netflix. It's just there, hanging there, but it's really it's still making a real point of being there on the wall. And I think that the exhibition really is about that. It's about you know, living with art is a long way away from the cold, austere, white, galleried, cubed space that perhaps we, you know, were really aware of in the 90s, that was the model that most galleries had. And I think times are changing, and people are looking at art in a different way and displaying it in a different context.
Yeah. No, I love that it brings it into the space of kind of the domestic.
Yeah, I just really want people to be able to feel that they can access it, and not, it's not elitist, and it's not so intimidating as being a gallery space that they can't go into, or they can't look at something, you know?
Yeah. Which also plays in lovely vein, Anna Miles Gallery is at Anna Miles' house.
Yeah, exactly. It's in her home and she lives there, and it's just lovely.
That was Kat Fuchs speaking to me about her current show, Didymus Mountain, which is on at Anna Miles Gallery until the 16th of August.
Yes, darling, but is it art?
We'll be right back.
I should burn in hell. to nail me
...95 BFM.
Do you like guitar music?
I'm
It's the 95 BFM Art Guide on various artists.
It's paintings in that.
This week in the wonderful world of art in Tāmaki Makaurau. As mentioned on the show, the tongue to them is on at Art Space Aotearoa on Karangahape Road until the 4th of October.
As mentioned on the show, Didymus Mountain by Kat Fuchs is on at Anna Miles Gallery until the 16th of August.
Lewis Cosgrave's show Little Rushes opens today from 5 till 8 p.m. at Straw House in Mount Eden.
How to Disappear by Steve Carr is on at Gow Langsford until the 23rd of August.
Miro by Weston Frizzell, the collective project of Otis Frizzell and Mike Weston, is on at Tafiau Art Salon until the 12th of August.
Throw by Philip Kelly, showing Charles Nino Gallery in the Lagonda Building on Karangahape Road. The exhibition runs until the 16th of August.
Paintings by Seraphine Pick is currently on at Michael Lett Gallery until the 23rd of August.
Our Bart Karu, Come Talk to Me, The Aperture of the Moon, is an exhibition by artist Kalpana Pandaram and Lisa Crowley on at Room until the 23rd of August. And remember, the film screenings for The Aperture of the Moon is held every Thursday at 11 p.m. at Room, and you can register online through the Room Instagram. I went last night and I highly recommend it, so please, please go ahead and see it.
Head along. We've also got Acts of Rest by Ruth and Esther Ege on at Season Gallery until the 23rd of August.
Peter Robinson and Giorgio Griffa dialogue exhibition, Difference in Kind and Rhythm, is on now at Te Uru until the 23rd of August. Oh, 24th.
24th! And tomorrow is the last day to catch Fore and Aft by Hawke's Bay-based artist John Brown on at Melanie Roger Gallery. If you have something you want on the Art Guide, you can email us at arts@95bfm.com.
That was the 95BFM Art Guide.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā.
That's all for us on various artists for today. Ngā mihi nui to everyone who spoke with us.
Artspace Aotearoa's Robbie Hancock
and Kat Fuchs.
Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in.
And remember, you can listen back to all of today's pieces on 95bfm.com.
Ka hoki mai mātou a te rā wiki. Next up is The Land of the Good Groove with Nigel. My name is Sophia.
I'm Maya.
And that was various artists.
We'll catch you next week.
You're listening to 95BFM.
Ka kite.
Ka kite.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.